General, Michelle S. Howland, Deputy Solicitor General, Robert A. Anderson, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Brittany M. Jones, Appalachia.
You may proceed. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Sheldon. This is Tom Walsh, and we represent Robert Stullis. The Virginia Code that criminalizes using a communication device to solicit a child less than 15 asks whether the defendant knew or had reason to believe the person was less than 15. And our argument is its language is unconstitutional, particularly in this case, where Stultz reasonably, objectively, and correctly believed that the person he was communicating with not less than 15. The jury indicated that they believed him, but the jury instruction, which followed the language of the statute, allowed a verdict finding Stultz guilty, even if the jury found that Stultz himself believed his target was not less than 15.
How do you know the jury believed him?
We don't know whether the jury believed him or not, and that's the issue. There is strong.
After being instructed, and they even got an instruction that you asked for that further amplified it, convicted them. So why would we infer from that that they believed him when he said, really, I truly, truly did not have any reason to believe she was less than 15?
There's no requirement for Stultz to win this case that you believe him. The issue is you don't know what the jury found. Because know or had reason to believe does not leave you knowing what the jury found when the jury finds Stultz guilty.
The verdict tells us that the jury found that he had reason to believe the person he was talking to or texting with was less than 15. That's irrefutable. I thought your argument was, well, yeah, but reason to believe is unconstitutionally vague.
It's unconstitutionally vague because just like in orthopedics and physical associates versus Summit, you're left with a question of what did the jury believe. Justice Kelsey, what you're telling me is exactly what the Commonwealth argued in this case and the Court of Appeals found, which is the jury found that Stultz believed this was a minor, case over.
He believed or had reason to believe.
That's right. Or had reason to believe.
Reason to believe is vague, and if that's true, we're going to have to strip out over a dozen statutes in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
No, Your Honor. If you find facially unconstitutional, yes. If you find that this statute is unconstitutional as applied to Stultz, then you won't have to adjust any of those statutes. And the reason why Stultz is different is because it is obvious on these facts in this case that the jury could find both that there was a reason to believe, find him guilty, but they could have found that Stultz himself did not believe the target was less than 15.
Well, can I address your first preface? The Court of Appeals held that you abandoned the facial challenge, and
yes.
There's no assignment of error contesting
yes.
that. So
that's right.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but that seems to me to be off the table.
I think it's wrong. I think our assignment of error clearly encompasses that finding. The parties knew that. The parties addressed it. We focused the record and the arguments on that finding. However, 99% of our argument is the as-applied. So I would argue that we have included that argument. However, I'm really focused, 99% of our brief and my argument is focused on as-applied. In orthopedics and physical therapy versus Summit LLC, the issue was that Summit was a group of doctors that induced the physical therapist to enter a lease. And physical therapists were getting all the referrals from doctors. As soon as they signed the lease, the doctor said no more referrals. The physical therapist backed out of the lease, and Summit sued for breach of lease. And the physical therapist countersued, arguing that they fraudulently induced them to enter the lease. The question at trial was, how would Summit be held liable for this fraudulent inducement? And so
I'm going to interrupt you once again. A facial challenge is this. The reason to believe standard, no one can understand it. No one will understand it ever. And let's assume we're not talking about a facial challenge. And as applied challenge is the unique situation that this one person found themselves in made it incapable of him to even begin to understand what reason to believe means. And no jury, given the very unique circumstances as applied to him, Well, what is the unique circumstance? He's just, he's on the web doing exactly what these kind of people do.
I disagree with you on every ground. He wasn't doing what these kind of people do. Read his advertisement. His advertisement couldn't be more designed to unlikely attract a teenager.
Well, as soon as he attracted someone that declared themselves to be a teenager, he followed up at every single...
Factually, if we start talking about all the facts, it's sufficiency evidence. That's not what we're talking about. Stoltz was presented with, very quickly, a picture of a grown-up, a 25-year-old. Stoltz very quickly was induced into a phone conversation with a 39-year-old, in which the 39-year-old asked Stoltz, how old are you? And he said, 34. And Stoltz's answer, after being told multiple times that the person was 13, said, how old are you? And she said, 13, and Stoltz laughed. There are plenty of facts to find a reason to believe that Stoltz thought this person was 13.
That's what juries are for. Juries saw the picture, read the email traffic, saw all of the facts of the case, and said, no, he did have reason to believe, and we disbelieved him.
Justice Kelsey, they didn't, and they couldn't have. You're not engaging the issue, which is there space in this jury instruction for the jury to find that Stoltz had a reason to believe the target was less than 15, and find that Stoltz himself didn't believe the target was less than 15. And let me explain why. Just give me an opportunity, Justice Kelsey.
Hold on 1 second. That is a facial challenge, because there's nothing unique about Stoltz. What I'm trying to point out is there's a structural problem you have to address before you can get to the specifics of your argument. I'm struggling conceptually. How is there an as-applied challenge at all? It just doesn't fit conceptually.
The as-applied challenge is based on the facts of this case, that Stoltz himself had facts, which most people don't have, that he was communicating with an adult. And the reason why it's a facial challenge is because we're using the facts of Stoltz's case and what happened to Stoltz. And then the jury asked the question that you would think a conscientious jury. If you want to give respect to jury findings, then this jury did what you expect would happen in a case like this. The jury asked, did Stoltz have to find the reason credible? And there's no way to interpret that question except that the jury was struggling with this instruction, knew or had reason to believe. And the jury was interpreting it exactly as I think anybody should interpret it, which is that we could find the defendant had a belief his target was over 15, but because he had a particular reason, what does this jury instruction tell us to do? And we cannot tell.
Can I follow up though with this? You added, or were you trial counsel?
No, Mr. Walsh was trial counsel.
Trial counsel added what I thought was actually a very fine instruction, but it amplifies the reason to believe point. And the principal point of it is the reason to believe point is, quote, a faculty of mind by which it distinguishes truth from falsehood, good from evil, etc. So that amplification seems to me to make it harder to reach the inference that you're trying to reach, which is they didn't know what they were doing. Reason to believe is you need to know what's true and what's not true. Is she 13 years old or is she 35 years old? Is this a picture of someone who's 25 years old or 15 years old? So why didn't the instruction that was given, which was a fine instruction, hurt your whole case because it amplified the very ambiguity you see?
No, no, Justice Kelsey. The faculty of the mind instruction, first of all, to me it's baffling. You know, all due respect to trial counsel, it's baffling. Faculty of the mind, I don't see how it helped the jury answer the question in the case, which is, could this jury have found that Stoltz himself believed the target was over 15, but still have found him guilty because there was a reason to believe? One, faculty of the mind does not help answering that question, the key issue in this case at all. And two, again, I just want to get to orthopedics and physical therapy associates versus Summit. In that case, the physical therapist gave the correct instruction of the law in finding Summit LLC liable. They said, you can find the LLC liable if a member of that LLC was acting in the ordinary course. That was the correct instruction. Summit offered an instruction saying, you can only find us liable if the LLC acts fraudulently. There's nothing wrong with that instruction, but it was not complete. Now, on appeal, Summit said, well, you shouldn't reverse based on our incorrect instruction or incomplete instruction that you can find us liable only if you find that Summit acted fraudulently, because they had another instruction which completed the reasoning. There was an instruction 13 in Summit, which was a correct instruction. And this court said we have a correct instruction, an incomplete instruction, and we don't know what the jury did. And because we don't know how they read those two instructions together, we're going to reverse. And this court found very important the fact that the jury asked the question, do the actions or non-actions of a minority portion of the group represent authority of the group? Because the jury asked that question in Summit, this court said, we know the jury asked a question about the wrong instruction. The jury was confused. We don't know what they did, so we will reverse.
So where's the wrong instruction in our case? What instruction?
No, or had reason to believe, because it allows...
That's a facial challenge, because that's the same instruction that's given in every single one of these cases. There's nothing unique about your case.
May I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Michelle Callan for the Commonwealth. I'd like to begin by noting what is not before the Court today, what this case is not about. This is not a sufficiency of the evidence case, nor is this a case where the defendant sought to offer a defense and was denied the opportunity to offer that defense. This case is purely a constitutional challenge to Virginia statute prohibiting solicitation of minors under the age of 15 over the internet. Now, with regard to Mr. Stoltz's facial challenge, the Court of Appeals held he waived it. He does not assign error to that finding, and the Court of Appeals was not plainly wrong as to the facial challenge. Now, as to the as-applied challenge, the statute is not unconstitutional. Stoltz's arguments fall into two buckets. First, he claims that Virginia's statute violates due process, and second, he has a First Amendment challenge. Regarding due process, he first claims that there is no mens rea in the statute, that the statute is unconstitutional because it's, in effect, strict liability. But the statute does have a mens rea. The mens rea is knows or reason to believe, and there are numerous statutes throughout Virginia, throughout other states, and throughout federal law that set forth that very same mens rea. Now, with regard to his vagueness argument, the statute provides sufficient notice for ordinary people to know what is or is not
prohibited. May I ask you this question? I think the way, when I looked at this, sort of how these things happen, you have someone who knows the person is a child younger than 15 years of age. So let's say you have someone who's a teacher, and it's one of their students, as we've seen, or a next-door neighbor, and you know for sure the exact age of the child. But with these computer interactions, you can't be certain. Someone may be posing as a minor. They may be dropping hints. They may be dancing around their age. But you have reason to know. So you can't say no because they may be sending you a false photograph or whatever. So one reading of that is essentially the person believes the person is younger than 15, but can't possibly know for sure. But we want to stop that kind of behavior. The other is a reading that the defense suggests, which is, well, he believed the person was an adult, but there were factual reasons that indicated the person might be a minor. So, did the instructions that were given to the jury... And maybe this doesn't go to the constitutional challenge, but it's sort of an issue with the statute broadly that the defense raises. Was the jury properly instructed on which interpretation is the right one, and what is the right interpretation?
So 2 points to that, Your Honor. The answer to your last question is yes, Your Honor. The jury was properly instructed. The jury was instructed in a manner that directly reflected the language of the statute at issue. The jury instruction that Mr. Stoltz asked for was to misconstrue the statute and read out a portion of the mens rea. With regard to the Commonwealth's view as to how to understand the statute, our view is that the best reading of the statute is that when a jury actually believes that a defendant knew that the person on the other end was an adult, then that precludes a finding that that same person still had a reason to believe that that person on the other end was under the age of 15. And so our view is that the reading, that his reading of the statute is something that, that's not the best reading of the statute. And to the extent this court views any ambiguity in the statute, we would ask the court to construe the statute in a manner that makes it, construe any ambiguity in favor of the statute's constitutionality.
I'm trying to figure out if it would be beneficial. His reason to believe might be ambiguous in some contexts. If it would be helpful to provide an additional clarifying instruction to the jury as to what that might mean.
I think in an ideal circumstances, that clarification would be great. The question is, in light of the circumstances that were presented here, was there, and here specifically, it's a constitutional challenge.
Right, and that's a different kettle of fish.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question? What is the standard to be applied to determining whether or not there's reason to believe? Is that any objective evidence? I mean, if you talk to someone and you think for sure that they're a certain age, you know, they sound like they're 60, they look like they're 60, but they say, but I'm 13, and you don't want to insult them, right? But you kind of like start laughing like, oh yeah, you're 13, and you go along with that. And then somebody says, well, did you have reason to believe they were 13? They told me they were, so I certainly had a reason, but I didn't believe it. I mean, there's some evidence that they provided me that they were 13, but I don't believe it. So would that person be convicted just because the person said it? So there is absolutely something, some reason to believe it, but it's not credible.
So I think the key two words that you noted in your question is the word a reason to believe, or the word some in some reason to believe. Neither of those words appear before reason to believe in the statute. The statute is knows or has reason to believe. So a single reason to believe in and of itself is not sufficient. The question is, and the question that the jury here examined, is whether, in light of all the circumstances, did Mr. Stoltz have reason to believe that the person on the other end was under 15? And so a single detective coming forward, when a detective is looking to, when a detective responds to an ad like this, and if that detective says, I'm 13, that in and of itself by itself is not as a matter of law sufficient under the statute. It's a question.
The defense instruction, despite the fact that they're not terribly pleased with it at this point, it flat out says that the reason is a faculty of the mind, is the ability to think, and is the ability to distinguish truth from falsehood. So, I mean, why isn't it clear that this is really going for willful blindness in situations where people choose to try to believe something differently than what all the facts are telling them is very likely to be true?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. I mean, the statute is construed in a manner to account both for the situation where a person actually knows the person on the other end is under 15 and in a situation of willful blindness.
In the same way, receipt of stolen goods, you know they're stolen or you have reason to believe they're stolen. You look at all the facts circumstantially and you ask yourself, well, did they have reason to believe? If they did, then they're guilty.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The thing I'm still struggling with, and honestly, I'm not getting too much help on the point, the argument is being made that reason to believe as a phrase, you know, is devoid of any meaning, which strikes me as not common sense. But nonetheless, that's the argument. That's a facial challenge. You see what I'm trying to say? As-applied challenges are not that. As-applied challenges in constitutional law, in 1983 law, is a constitutional claim that says, look, it's okay for everyone. There's nothing wrong with the phrase. But as applied to me, because of the very odd circumstances I find myself in, the phrase won't work. It's too vague. What's wrong with what I'm thinking from your perspective, if anything?
Nothing, Your Honor. I think the confusion might arise from the fact that this case would have been better brought to this court as a kind of as a more jury instruction, a traditional appeal from a failure to provide.
It's really a sufficiency case is all it is.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there was no, the only jury instruction at issue here, the only debate over jury instruction is whether the instruction reflect the statute accurately or whether the instruction misconstrue the statute. It's not one in which there was a request to have an instruction to tell the jury, your jury, if you believe that I knew for a fact that Annie all along was over the age of 15, you cannot find me guilty under the statute. That was not a jury instruction that they sought, and that's not an issue on appeal here. But you're correct, Your Honor, that the arguments that are made here are essentially all facial challenges, aside from the argument to say that the jury actually believed me all along, but nevertheless, in light of the jury instructions, felt constrained to find me guilty. And that essentially boils down to a sufficiency of evidence type case wherein he's asking this court to construe the evidence in the light most favorable to him and to guess and to assume that the jury believed him all along, and he's not entitled to that assumption. The goal of these statutes is to protect is to catch predators before they hurt children. And accepting Stoltz's representation and invalidating Virginia's statute would seriously harm that effort. For those reasons, Your Honors, and unless the court has any additional questions, we ask that you affirm. Thank you.
So the statute reads, "No, knew or had reason to believe." And what happens in most cases is when the teacher contacts a student, the neighbor contacts a neighbor. This is not an issue. It's not an issue because the neighbor knows his 14-year-old neighbor. The teacher knows the 14-year-old student. It's not an issue. It's not an issue in most jurisdictions because there are few detectives that send pictures of grown-ups and have grown-up detectives call targets. Few of them. Most people use children, pictures of children, and they don't make these phone calls. Justice Goodwin, to your point, could this statute be interpreted that any reason to believe, could know or had reason to believe, be interpreted by the jury as a reason? Of course it could. That's what the prosecutor argued. At page 78 of the joint appendix, the prosecutor argued he had a reason to believe. At page 839 of the appendix, the prosecutor argued he's guilty because he had reason to believe when the detective said, "I'm 13. And Justice Goodwin, your situation is not a fanciful one. This 60-year-old says, "I'm 13. Could you be held guilty? Of course you could. That's this case. A picture of a 25-year-old, the picture's in the record. The conversation, 9 minutes with a 39-year-old, the conversation's in the record. If Stoltz met this 39-year-old and had sex with her, with the detective, as has happened in Fairfax, we have our detectives having sex with their targets, he still would be guilty under the statute after having sex with a 39-year-old. And the statute is unconstitutional as applied to Stoltz. Because if you know your target, there's no problem here. If you don't know your target and you're provided reasons to believe, but they're not credible, then it's unconstitutional. In the stolen goods context, in Arizona versus Ware, the Arizona Supreme Court said the language "know or have reason to believe" is unconstitutional when the jury is instructed that the target of the stolen goods must intend to receive them, and a reasonable person would have known they're stolen. And as the Arizona Supreme Court said, the language "know or have reason to believe" in stolen goods is unconstitutional as applied to Ware, because applying a reasonable person standard, a negligence standard, is too low in the criminal law.
So you can't have negligent homicide?
You can't have a negligence in this case, well, in this kind of case.
Why is criminal law not able to enforce a negligence standard? Criminal negligence is actually a doctrine of criminal law.
Well, I think Alanis is the 2015 U.S. Supreme Court case. Alanis is the best example of why we don't have negligence in the criminal law as a matter of course. Alanis was a case where this guy made incredible threats on Facebook to the FBI, to his wife, to his employers, and to a school. Just obvious threats, and the he was charged with the intent to communicate threats in interstate commerce. And he said, "Dismiss this indictment. I must have intended the communication to be a threat." And the jury is instructed that he only must have intended the communication, and that a reasonable person would have understood the communication to be a threat. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, we don't have that in the criminal law. And the reason we don't have that is because it's a basic principle that wrongdoing must be conscious to be criminal. And this negligence standard does away with that consciousness. And Alanis goes on at 2009 for an entire page to describe why negligence is insufficient in the criminal law. This is a case where the facts and fair facts come up again and again, but you don't see it from other jurisdictions because you're not presenting all this information about grown-ups. The deputies are not using this as a shield against children. They're using this as a sword. These are unusual circumstances, and we would ask that this court find the statute unconstitutional as applied to Stulls. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the